It doesn't matter, Andral said. The Black Tower has learned to survive without him. Light. It always survived without him. He barely had anything to do with us. It was Loghain who gave us hope. It is Loghain who will have my allegiance. The others nodded. Pavara felt something important happening here. They couldn't have leaned upon him forever anyway, she thought. The dragon reborn will die at the last battle. By intention or not, he had given them the chance to become their own men. I will take his last order to heart, however, Andral said. I will not be merely a weapon. The taint is cleansed. We fight not to die, but to live. We have a reason to live. Spread the word among the other men, and let us take oaths to uphold Loghain as our leader, and then to the last battle. Not as minions of the Dragon Reborn, not as pawns of the Ammerlin Seat, but as the Black Tower, our own men. Our own men, the other three whispered, nodding. Chapter 22 The Willed. Egwene was shocked awake as Gawain clamped his hand over her mouth. She tensed, memories returning like the light of a sunrise. They were still hiding beneath the broken cart. The air still smelled of burned wood. The land nearby was dark as coal. Night had fallen. She looked to Gawain and nodded. Had she really drifted off? She wouldn't have thought it possible under the circumstances. I'm going to try to slip away, Gawain whispered, and make a distraction. I'll go with you. I can go more quietly.
Obviously you've never tried to sneak up on someone from the Two Rivers, Gawain Trekhand, she said. I'd bet you 100 Tarvalen marks that I'm the quieter of the two.
Yes, Gawain whispered. But if you draw within a dozen steps of one of their channelers, you'll be spotted, no matter how quiet. They've been patrolling through camp, particularly at the perimeters.
She frowned. How did he know that?
You went out scouting.
A little, he whispered. I wasn't seen. They're scavenging through the tents, taking captive anyone they find. We won't be able to hide here much longer.
He should not have gone out without asking her.
We...
Gawain stiffened, and Egwene cut off, listening. Feet, shuffling. The two of them pulled back, watching as 10 or 12 captives were led into an open space near where the command tent had stood. Sharans placed torches on poles around the ragged prisoners. A few of these were soldiers, beaten to the point where they could barely walk. There were cooks and laborers as well. They had been lashed, their trousers frayed. All of their shirts had been removed. On their backs, someone had tattooed a symbol that Egwene did not recognize. At least, she thought they were tattoos. The symbols might have been burned into them. As the captives were gathered, someone yelled nearby. In a few minutes, a dark-skinned Sharan guard walked up, dragging a young messenger boy he'd apparently found hiding in camp. He ripped off the boy's shirt and shoved him crying to the ground. The Sharans oddly wore clothing that had a large diamond shape cut out of the back. Egwene could see that the guard bore a mark on his own back, a tattoo she could barely make out against his dark skin. His clothing was very formal, with a large, stiff robe that came almost to his knees. It didn't have sleeves, but underneath he wore a shirt with a diamond cutout that had long sleeves. Another Sharan came out of the darkness, and this man was almost completely naked. He wore ripped trousers, but no shirt. Instead of a tattoo on his back, he had tattoos all across his shoulders. They crept up his neck like twisted vines before reaching up to cup his jaw and cheeks. They looked like 100 twisted hands, long fingers with claws holding his head from below. This man went over to the kneeling messenger boy. The other guards shuffled. They weren't comfortable with this fellow, whoever he was. He held out a hand, sneering. The boy's back burned suddenly with a tattoo mark like that of the other captives. Smoke rose, and the boy cried out in pain. Gawain exhaled softly in shock. That man with the tattoos running up onto his face, that man could channel. Several of the guards muttered. She could almost understand the words, but they had a thick accent. The channeler snapped like a feral dog. The guards stepped back, and the channeler prowled off, disappearing into the shadows. Light, Egwene thought. Rustling in the darkness resolved into two women in the wide silk dresses. One had lighter skin, and as Egwene searched, she found that some of the soldiers did too. Not all Sharans were dark as the fellows she'd seen so far. The women's faces were very beautiful, delicate. Egwene shrank back. From what she had seen earlier, these two would probably be channelers. If they stepped too close to Egwene, they might sense her. The two women inspected the captives. By the light of their lanterns, Egwene made out tattoos on their faces as well, though theirs were not as disturbing as those upon the men. These were like leaves, tattooed from the back of the neck forward, going under the ears and spreading like blossoms on the cheeks. The two women whispered to one another, and again Egwene felt as if she could almost understand them. If she could weave a thread to listen. Idiot, she thought. Channeling would get her killed here. Others gathered around the captives. Egwene held her breath. 100, 200 more people approached. They did not talk much. They seemed a quiet, solemn people, these Sharans. Most of those who came had open backs to their garments, revealing their tattoos. Were those symbols of status? She had assumed that the more important one was, the more intricate the tattoos. However, officers, she had to assume that was what they were, with their feathered helmets and fine silken coats and golden armor made as if of coins that had been sewn together through the holes at their centers. They had only small openings, revealing tiny tattoos at the base of shoulders. They've removed pieces of armor to display the tattoos, she thought. Surely they did not do battle with the skin exposed. This was something done during more formal times. The last people who joined the crowd, ushered to the front, were the strangest of all. Two men and a woman atop small donkeys, all three wearing beautiful silk skirts, their animals draped with gold and silver chains. Plumes of vibrant colors fanned out from intricate headdresses upon these three. They were nude from the waist up, including the woman, save for the jewelry and necklaces that covered much of their chests. Their backs were exposed, their heads shaven just on the back to show their necks. There were no tattoos. So, lords of some sort? Except all three had hollow, haunted expressions. They slumped forward, eyes down, faces wan. Their arms seemed thin, almost skeletal, so frail. What had been done to these people? It made no sense to her. The Sharans were undoubtedly a people as baffling as the Aiel, probably more so. But why come now? Egwene thought. Why, after centuries upon centuries of isolation, have they finally decided to invade? There were no coincidences, not of this magnitude. These had come to ambush Egwene's people, and had worked with the Trollocs. She let herself seize upon that. Whatever she learned here would be of vital importance. She could not help her army right now. Light send that some of its members at least had managed to flee, so she should learn what she could. Gawain prodded her softly. She looked to him, and felt his worry for her. Now? He mouthed, gesturing behind them. Perhaps with everyone's attention drawn by whatever was happening, the two of them could sneak away. They started to back up, shuffling quietly. One of the Sharan channelers called out. Egwene froze. She'd been spotted. No, no. Egwene breathed deeply, trying to calm her heart, which seemed to be trying to beat its way out through her chest. The woman was speaking to the others. Egwene thought she'd heard the words, "It is done," through the thick accent. The group of people knelt down. The bejeweled trio bowed their heads further. And then, near the captives, the air bent. Egwene couldn't describe it any other way. It warped and seemed to rip apart, twisting like it did above the road on a hot day. Something formed from this disruption. A tall man in glistening armor. He wore no helmet and had dark hair and light skin. His nose was slightly hooked, and he was very handsome, particularly in that armor. It looked to be constructed all of coins, silvery and overlapping. The coins were polished to such a shine, they reflected the faces around him like a mirror.
"You have done well,"
the man announced to those bowing before him.
"You may stand."
His voice bore hints of the Sharan accent, but it was not nearly as thick. The man placed his hand on the pommel of the sword at his waist as the others rose. From the darkness behind, a group of the channelers crawled forward. They bobbed for this newcomer in a kind of bow. He removed one of his gauntlets, reached out with an offhanded gesture, and scratched the head of one of the men, as a lord might favor a hound.
"So these are the new Inakal," the man said speculatively. "Do any of you know who I am?"
The captives cringed before him. Though the Sharans had risen, the captives were smart enough to remain on the ground. None of them spoke.
"I suspected not," the man said, "though one can never tell if one's fame has spread unexpectedly. Tell me, if you know who I am. Speak it, and I will let you free."
No replies.
"Well, you will listen and remember," the man said. "I am Bao, the Willed. I am your savior. I have crawled through the depths of sorrow and have risen up to accept my glory. I have come seeking what was taken from me. Remember that."
The captives cowered further, obviously uncertain what to do. Gawain tugged on Egwene's sleeve, motioning backward, but she did not move. There was something about that man. He looked up suddenly. He focused on the women channelers, then gazed about, peering into the darkness.
"Do any of you Inakal know the dragon?"
he asked, though he sounded distracted.
"Speak up. Tell me."
"I did see him," said one of the captive soldiers. "Several times."
"Did you speak with him?"
Bao asked, strolling away from the captives.
"No, great lord," the soldier said. "The Aes Sedai, they did speak with him. Not I."
"Yes, I worried you would be of no use," Bao said. "Servants, we are being watched. You have not searched this camp as well as you claimed. I sense a woman nearby who can channel."
Egwene felt a spike of alarm. Gawain pulled on her arm, meaning to go, but if they ran, they'd be captured for certain. "Light! She..." The crowd turned at a sudden noise near one of the fallen tents. Bao raised a hand, and Egwene heard a furious yell in the darkness. Moments later, Lyanna floated through the crowd of Sharans, tied in air, her eyes wide. Bao brought her up close to him, holding her wrapped in weaves that Egwene could not see. Her heart continued to pound. Lyanna was alive. How had she remained hidden? Light! What could Egwene do?
"Ah," Bao said. "One of these Aes Sedai. You have spoken with the dragon."
Lyanna didn't respond. To her credit, she kept her face blank.
Impressive,
Vao said, reaching up fingers and touching her chin. He held up another hand, and the collected captives suddenly started to writhe and scream. They burst into flames, yelling in agony. Egwene had to forcibly stop herself from reaching for the true source as she watched. She was crying by the time it ended, though she did not remember starting. The Sharans shuffled.
Do not be displeased, Bao said to them. I know you went to great trouble to take some alive for me, but they would have made poor Inakal. They are not raised to it, and during this war we do not have time to train them. Killing them now is a mercy compared to what they would have had to endure. Besides, this Aes Sedai will serve our purpose.
Lyanna's mask had cracked, and despite the distance, Egwene could see her hatred. Bao still had her chin cupped in his hand.
You are a beautiful thing, he said. Unfortunately, beauty is meaningless. You are to deliver a message for me, Aes Sedai, to Luz Theron, the one who calls himself the Dragon Reborn. Tell him that I have come to slay him, and in so doing, I will claim this world. I will take what originally should have been mine. Tell him that. Message for me, Aes Sedai, to Luz Theron, the one who calls himself the Dragon Reborn. Tell him that I have come to slay him, and in so doing, I will claim this world. I will take what originally should have been mine. Tell him that. Tell him you have seen me and describe me to him. He will know me. Just as the people here awaited him with prophecy, just as they showered him with glory, the people of my land awaited me. I have fulfilled their prophecies. He is false, and I am true. Tell him I will finally have satisfaction. He is to come to me so that we may face one another. If he does not, I will slaughter and destroy. I will seize his people. I will enslave his children. I will take his women for my own. One by one, I will break, destroy, or dominate everything he has loved. The only way for him to avoid this is for him to come and face me. Tell him this, little Aes Sedai. Tell him that an old friend awaits. I am Bao, the Willed. He who is owned only by the land, the Dragon Slayer. He knew me once by a name I have scorned. The name Barid Bel.
Barid Bel? Egwene thought, memories from her lessons in the White Tower returning to her. Barid Bel Maedar. Demon Dread.
A storm in the wolf dream was a changeable thing. Perrin spent hours prowling the borderlands, visiting packs of wolves as he ran down dry riverbeds and across broken hills. Gaul had learned quickly. He wouldn't stand for a moment against Slayer, of course, but at least he had learned to keep his clothing from changing, though his veil did still snap up to cover his face when he was startled. The two of them bounded through Kandor, leaving blurs in the air as they moved from hilltop to hilltop. The storm was sometimes strong, sometimes weak. At the moment, Kandor was hauntingly still. The grassy highland landscape was strewn with all kinds of debris. Tents, roofing tiles, the sail of a large ship, even a blacksmith's anvil, deposited point first into a muddy hillside. The dangerously powerful storm could arise anywhere in the wolf dream and rip apart cities or forests. He'd found Tyran hats blown all the way to Shinar. Perrin came to rest on a hilltop, Gaul streaking into place beside him. How long had they been searching for Slayer? A few hours, it seemed, on one hand. On the other, how much ground had they crossed? They had returned to their food stores now 3 times to eat. Did that mean a day had passed?
Gaul, Perrin said. How long have we been at this?
I cannot say, Perrin Ibarra, Gaul replied. He checked for the sun, though there was none.
A long while. Will we need to stop and sleep?
That was a good question. Perrin's stomach suddenly growled, and he made them a meal of dried meat and a hunk of bread. He gave some to Gaul. Would summoned bread sustain them in the wolf dream, or would it merely vanish once they consumed it? The latter. The food vanished even as Perrin ate it. They would need to rely upon their supplies, perhaps getting more from Rans Ashaman during the daily opening of their portal. For now, he shifted back to their packs and dug out some dried meat, then rejoined Gaul in the north. As they settled down on the hillside to eat again, he found himself dwelling on the dream spike. He carried it with him, turned to its slumbering position, as Lanfear had taught him. It made no dome now, but he could make one when he wished. Lanfear had all but given it to him. What did that mean? Why did she taunt him? He ripped at a hunk of dried meat. Was Fahil safe? If the shadow discovered what she was doing, well, he wished he could at least check on her. He took a long drink from his water skin, then searched outward for the wolves. There were hundreds of them up here in the borderlands, perhaps thousands. He gave those nearby a greeting, sending his scent mixed with his image. The dozen replies that came were not words, but his mind understood them as such.
Young bull. This from a wolf named White Eyes. The last hunt is here. Will you lead us?
Many asked this lately, and Perrin couldn't figure out how to interpret it.
Why do you need me to lead you?
It will be your call, White Eyes replied.
By your howl. I don't understand what you mean, Perrin said. Can you not hunt on your own? Not this prey, young bull.
Perrin shook his head, a response like others he'd received.
White Eyes, he sent. Have you seen Slayer, the killer of wolves? Has he stalked you here?
Perrin sent it out broadly, and some of the other wolves replied. They knew of Slayer. His image and scent had been passed among many wolves, much as had Perrin's own. None had seen him recently, but time was an odd thing to wolves. Perrin wasn't certain how recent their recently really was. Perrin took a bite of dried meat and caught himself growling softly. He stifled that. He had come to a peace with the wolf inside of him, but that didn't mean he intended to let it start tracking mud into the house.
Young bull,
another wolf sent. Turnbow, an aged female pack leader.
Moonhunter walks the dreams again. She seeks you.
Thank you, he sent back. I know this. I will avoid her.
Avoid the moon? Turnbow sent back. A difficult thing, young bull.
Difficult.
She had the right of that.
I saw Heartseeker just now, sent Steps, a black-furred youth. She wears a new scent. But it is her.
Other wolves sent agreement. Heartseeker was in the wolf dream. Some had seen her to the east, but others said that she had been seen to the south. But what of Slayer? Where was the man, if not hunting wolves? Perrin caught himself growling again. Heartseeker. That must be one of the Forsaken, though he didn't recognize the images they sent of her. She was ancient, and so were the memories of wolves, but often the things they remembered were fragments of fragments that their ancestors had seen.
Any news? Gaul said. Another one of the Forsaken is here, Perrin said with a grunt, doing something to the east.
Does it involve us?
The Forsaken always involve us, Perrin said, standing.
He reached down, touched Gaul on the shoulder, and shifted them in the direction steps had indicated. The position wasn't exact, but once Perrin arrived, he found some wolves who had seen Heartseeker on their way to the borderlands the day before. They sent Perrin eager greetings, asking if he was going to lead them. He rebuffed their questions, pinpointing where Heartseeker had been spotted. It was Marilor. Perrin shifted there. A strange mist hung over the landscape here. Tall trees, the ones Rand had grown, reflected here, and their lofty tops poked out of the mist above. Tents dotted the landscape like the tops of mushrooms. Aiel tents were plentiful, and between them cook fires glowed in the mist. This camp had been here long enough to manifest in the wolf dream, though tent flaps changed places and bedrolls vanished, flickering in the insubstantial way of this place. Perrin led Gaul between the neat rows of tents and horseless horse pickets. They both froze as they heard a sound. Someone muttering. Perrin used the trick he'd seen Lanfear use, creating a pocket of something around himself that was invisible, but which stopped sound. It was strange, but he did it by creating a barrier with no air in it. Why would that make the sound stop? He and Gaul crept forward to the canvas of a tent. That of the man Rodol Aitaralda, one of the great captains, judging by the banner. Inside, a woman in trousers picked through documents on a table. They kept vanishing in her fingers. Perrin didn't recognize her, though she was painfully homely. That certainly wasn't what he'd have expected from one of the Forsaken. Not that large forehead, bulbous nose, uneven eyes, or thinning hair. He didn't recognize her curses, though he grasped the meaning from her tone. Gaul looked at him, and Perrin reached for his hammer, but hesitated. Attacking Slayer was one thing, but one of the Forsaken? He was confident of his ability to resist weaves here in the wolf dream. But still... The woman cursed again as the paper she was reading vanished. Then she looked up. Perrin's reaction was immediate. He created a paper-thin wall between her and him, her side painted with an exact replica of the landscape behind him, his side transparent. She looked right at him, but didn't see him, and turned away. Beside him, Gaul let out a very soft breath of relief.
"How did I do that?" Perrin thought.
It wasn't something he had practiced. It had merely seemed right. Heartseeker, this had to be she, waved her fingers, and the tent split in half above her, the canvas flaps hanging down. She rose through the air, moving toward the black tempest above. Perrin whispered to Gaul,
"Wait here, and watch for danger."
Gaul nodded. Perrin cautiously followed Heartseeker, lifting himself into the air with a thought. He tried to form another wall between himself and her, but it was too difficult to keep the right image displayed while moving. Instead, he kept his distance and put a blank, brownish-green wall between him and the Forsaken, hoping that if she happened to glance down, she'd pass over the small oddity. She began to move more quickly, and Perrin forced himself to keep up. He glanced down and was rewarded with the stomach-churning sight of Marilor's landscape dwindling below. Then it grew dark and vanished into blackness. They didn't pass through the clouds. As the ground faded away, so did the clouds, and they entered someplace black. Pinpricks of light appeared all around Perrin. The woman above stopped and hung in the air for a few moments before streaking away to the right. Perrin followed again, coloring himself, his skin, his clothing, everything, black to hide. The woman approached one of the pinpricks of light until it expanded and dominated the sky in front of her. Heartseeker reached her hands forward and pressed them against the light. She was muttering to herself. Feeling he needed to hear what she was saying, Perrin dared move closer, though he suspected that the pounding of his heart was so loud it would give him away.
"Take it from me," she said. "You think I care? Give me a face of broken stone. What do I care? That's not me. I will have your place, Moradin. It will be mine. This face will just make them underestimate me, burn you."
Perrin frowned. He couldn't make much sense of what she was saying.
"Go ahead and throw your armies at them, you fools," she continued to herself. "I'll have the greater victory. An insect can have 1,000 legs, but only 1 head. Destroy the head, and the day is yours. All you're doing is cutting off the legs, stupid fool. Stupid, arrogant, insufferable fool. I'll have what is due me. I'll..."
She hesitated, then pivoted. Perrin, spooked, immediately sent himself to the ground. It worked, thankfully. He hadn't known if it would up in that place of lights. Gaul jumped, and Perrin took a deep breath.
"Let's..."
A ball of blazing fire crashed into the ground beside him. Perrin cursed and rolled, cooling himself with a gust of wind, imagining his hammer up into his hand. Heartseeker dropped to the ground in a wave of energy, power rippling around her.
"Who are you?" she demanded. "Where are you? I..."
She focused suddenly on Perrin, seeing him completely for the first time, the blackness having faded from his clothing.
"You!" she screeched. "You are to blame for this!"
She raised her hands. Her eyes almost seemed to glow with hatred. Perrin could smell the emotion in spite of the blowing wind. She released a white-hot bar of light, but Perrin bent it around himself. The woman started. They always did that. Didn't they realize that nothing was real here except what you thought to be real? Perrin vanished, appearing behind her, raising his hammer. Then he hesitated. A woman? She spun about, screaming and ripping the earth beneath him. He jumped up into the sky, and the air around him tried to seize him. But he did what he'd done before, creating a wall of nothingness. There was no air to grab him. Holding his breath, he vanished and appeared back on the ground, summoning banks of earth in front of him to block the balls of fire that hurtled his way.
"I want you dead," the woman screamed. "You should be dead. My plans were perfect."
Perrin vanished, leaving behind a statue of himself. He appeared beside the tent, where Gaul watched carefully, spear raised. Perrin put up a wall between them and the woman, coloring it to hide them, and made a barrier to block the sound.
"She can't hear us now," Perrin said.
"You are strong here," Gaul said thoughtfully.
"Very strong. Do the wise ones know of this?" "I'm still a pup compared to them," Perrin said.
"Perhaps," Gaul said. "I have not seen them, and they do not speak of this place to men."
He shook his head.
"Much honor, Perrin Ebarra. You have much honor." "I should have just struck her down,"
Perrin said, as Heartseeker destroyed the statue of him, then stepped up to it, looking confused. She turned about, searching frantically.
"Yes," Gaul agreed. "A warrior who will not strike a maiden is a warrior who refuses her honor. Of course, the greater honor for you would be to take her captive."
Could he do it? Perrin took a breath, then sent himself behind her, imagining vines reaching around her to hold her in place. The woman howled curses at him, slicing the vines with unseen blades. She reached her hand toward Perrin, and he shifted to the side. His feet crunched on bits of frost on the ground that he hadn't noticed, and she immediately spun on him and released another weave of balefire.
Clever,
Perrin thought, barely managing to bend the light away. It struck the hillside behind, drilling a hole straight through it. Heartseeker continued the weave, snarling, hideous face distorted. The weave bent back toward Perrin, and he gritted his teeth, keeping it at bay.
She was strong.
She pushed hard, but finally she released it, panting.
"How? How can you possibly..."
Perrin filled her mouth with fork root. It was difficult to do. Changing anything directly about a person was always harder. However, this was much easier than trying to transform her into an animal or the like. She raised a hand to her mouth, eyes adopting a look of panic. She began to spit and hack, then desperately opened a gateway beside her. Perrin growled, imagining ropes reaching for her, but she destroyed them with a weave of fire. She must have gotten the fork root out. She hurled herself through the gateway, and he shifted himself to be right in front of it, preparing to leap through. He froze when he saw her entering the middle of an enormous army of Trollocs and Fades at night. Many faced the gateway, eager. Perrin stepped back as Heartseeker raised a hand to her mouth, looking aghast and coughing out more fork root. The gateway closed.
"You should have killed her,"
Lanfear said. Perrin turned to find the woman standing nearby, her arms folded. Her hair had changed from silver to dark brown. In fact, her face had changed, too, becoming slightly more like it had been before when he'd first seen her nearly 2 years ago. Perrin said nothing, returning his hammer to its straps.
"This is a weakness, Perrin,"
Lanfear said.
"I found it charming in Luz Theron at one point, but that doesn't make it any less a weakness. You need to overcome it."
"I will," he snapped. "What was she doing, up there with the balls of light?"
"Invading dreams," Lanfear said. "She was here in the flesh. That affords one certain advantages, particularly when playing with dreams. That hussy. She thinks she knows this place, but it has always been mine. It would have been best if you'd killed her."
"That was Grendel, wasn't it?" Perrin asked. "Or was it Mogadine?"
"Grendel," Lanfear said. "Though again, we are not to use that name for her. She's been renamed Hesalam."
"Hesalam," Perrin said, trying the word out in his mouth. "I don't know it."
"It means without forgiveness."
"And what is your new name? The one we're supposed to call you now?"
That actually pulled a blush out of her.
"Never mind," she said. "You are skilled here in Telairon Riad. Much better than Luz Theron ever was. I always thought I would rule at his side, that only a man who could channel would be worthy of me. But the power you display here, I think I may accept it as a substitute."
Perrin grunted. Gaul had moved across the small clearing between the camp tents, spear raised, Shufa covering his face. Perrin waved him off. Not only was Lanfear likely to be much better with the wolf dream than Gaul, but she hadn't done anything specifically threatening yet.
"If you've been watching me," Perrin said, "you'll know that I'm married. Quite happily."
"So I have seen."
"Then stop looking at me like a flank of beef hung up for display in the market," Perrin growled. "What was Grendel doing here? What does she want?"
"I'm not certain,"
Lanfear said lightly.
"She always has three or four plots going at the same time. Don't underestimate her, Perrin. She's not as skilled here as some others, but she is dangerous. She's a fighter, unlike Mogadine, who will run from you whenever she can."
"I'll keep that in mind," Perrin said, walking up to the place where she'd vanished by gateway.
He prodded at the earth where the gateway had cut the ground.
"You could do that, you know,"
Lanfear said. He spun on her.
"What?"
"Go back and forth into the waking world," she said, "without requiring the help of one like Luz Theron."
Perrin didn't like the way she sneered when she said his name. She tried to cover it up, but he smelled hatred on her whenever she mentioned him.
"I can't channel," Perrin said. "I suppose I could imagine being able to."
"It wouldn't work," she said. "There are limits to what one can accomplish here, regardless of how strong the mind. The ability to channel is not a thing of the body, but a thing of the soul. There are still ways for one such as you to move back and forth between worlds in the flesh. The one you call Slayer does it."
"He's not a wolf, brother."
"No,"
she said.
"But he is something similar. I'm honestly not certain another has had his skills before. The Dark One did something to this Slayer when capturing his soul, or his souls. I suspect Semirag might have been able to tell us more. It's a pity she's dead.
Lanfear didn't smell of pity at all. She glanced at the sky, but was calm, not worried.
You don't seem as worried about being spotted as you once were, Perrin noted. My former master is occupied. This last week, watching you, I've rarely felt his eyes on me.
Weak? Perrin asked, shocked. But
time passes oddly here, she said, and the barriers of time itself are fraying. The closer you are to the boar, the more time will distort. For those who approach Shale Ghul in the real world, it will be just as bad. For every day that passes to them, three or four might pass to those more distant.
A week? Light. How much had happened on the outside? Who lived and who had died while Perrin hunted? He should wait at the traveling ground for his portal to open. But judging by the darkness he'd seen through Grendel's gateway, it was night. Perrin's escape portal could be hours away.
You could make a gateway for me, Perrin said. A pathway out, then back in. Will you?
Lanfear considered it, strolling past one of the flickering tents and letting her fingers trail on the canvas as it vanished.
No,
she finally said.
But you must learn to do this thing for yourself if we are to be together.
We're not going to be together, he said flatly.
You need this power of and for yourself, she said, ignoring what he had said. You are weak so long as you are trapped only in one of the worlds. Being able to come here when you want will give you great power.
I don't care about power, Lanfear, he said, watching her as she continued to stroll.
She was pretty. Not as pretty as Fael, of course. Beautiful, nonetheless.
Don't you?
She faced him.
Have you never thought of what you could do with more strength, more power, more authority?
That won't tempt me to.
Save lives, she said. Prevent children from starving, stop the weak from being bullied, end wickedness, reward honor, power to encourage men to be straightforward and honest with one another?
He shook his head.
You could do so much good, Perrin Ebarra, she said, walking up to him, then touching the side of his face, running her fingers down his beard.
Tell me how to do what Slayer does, Perrin said, pushing her hand away. How does he move between worlds?
I cannot explain it to you, she said, turning away. As it is a skill I have never had to learn. I use other methods. Perhaps you can beat it out of him. I would be quick, assuming you wish to stop Grendel.
Stop her, Perrin said.
Didn't you realize?
Lanfear turned back to him.
The dream she was invading was not one of the people from this camp. Space and distance matter not to dreams. That dream you saw her invading, it belongs to Davram Bashir, father of your wife.
With that, Lanfear vanished. Chapter 23. At the Edge of Time. Gawain tugged urgently on Egwene's shoulder. Why wouldn't she move? Whoever that man was in the armor made of silver discs, he could sense female channelers. He'd picked Lyanna out of the darkness. He could do the same for Egwene. Light, he probably would, as soon as he took a moment to notice. I'm going to haul her up onto my shoulder if she doesn't move, he thought. Light help me, I'll do it, no matter how much noise it makes. We're going to be caught anyway if we... The one who called himself Bao moved off, towing Lyanna, still wrapped in air, with him. The others followed in a mass, leaving the awful charred remnants of the other captives behind.
Egwene, Gawain whispered.
She looked at him, a cold strength in her eyes, and nodded.
light. How could she be so calm when he had to clench his teeth for fear they would start rattling together?
They wriggled out from under the cart backward, moving on their stomachs until they emerged. Egwene glanced in the direction of the Sharans. Her cold sense of control radiated into his mind from the bond. Hearing that man's name had done that to her, given her a sudden spike of shock followed by grim determination.
What was that name? Barid something?
Gawain thought he'd heard it before. He wanted Egwene out of this death trap. He put the water cloak around her shoulders.
The best way out is directly east, he whispered. Around the mess tent, what's left of it, then on to the camp perimeter. They have a guard post set up next to what was our traveling ground. We'll go around that to the north side.
She nodded.
I'll scout ahead, you follow, Gawain said. If I see anything, I'll toss a stone back toward you. Listen for it hitting, all right? Count to 20, then follow me at a slow pace. But you can't go first, lest we run across some of those channelers. I need to take the lead.
At least wear the cloak, she hissed.
I'll be fine, he whispered,
then slipped away before she could argue further. He did feel her spike of annoyance and suspected he'd get an earful once they were out of this. Well, if they lived long enough for that to happen, he'd accept the reprimand happily. Once he was a short distance from her, he slipped on one of the rings of the blood knives. He had activated it with his blood, as Lalwyn had said was needed. She'd also said it might kill him.
You're a fool, Gawain Drakand, he thought as a tingling sensation ran across his body.
Though he'd used the Tirangrial only once before, he knew that his figure had been blurred and darkened. If people glanced in his direction, their eyes would slide away from him. It worked particularly well in shadows. For once, he was pleased that those clouds blocked out any moonlight or starlight. He moved on, stepping carefully. Earlier in the night, when he'd first tested the ring as Egwene slept, he'd been able to pass within a few steps of sentries holding lanterns. One had looked right at Gawain, but hadn't seen him. In this much darkness, he might as well have been invisible. The Tirangrial allowed him to move more quickly as well. The change was slight, but noticeable. He itched to try out the ability in a duel. How many of these Sharans could he take out on his own while wearing one of these rings? A dozen? Two? That would last right up until one of those channelers cooked you, Gawain told himself. He collected a few pebbles off the ground to toss back toward Egwene if he spotted one of the female channelers. He looped around the mess tent, following the path he'd scouted earlier. It was important to keep reminding himself to be careful. Earlier, the Tirangrial's power had made him too bold. It was a heady thing, knowing how easily he could move. He told himself he wouldn't use the rings, but that had been during battle, when he'd been tempted to try to make a name for himself. This was different. This was protecting Egwene. He could allow an exception for this.
The moment she hit the count of 20, Egwene moved into the darkness. She wasn't as good at sneaking as Nynaeve and Perrin were, but she was from the Two Rivers. Every child in Emmon's Field learned how to move in the woods without startling game. She turned her attention to the path before her, testing with her toes, she'd removed her shoes, to avoid dried leaves or weeds. Moving this way was second nature to her. That left her mind free, unfortunately. One of the Forsaken led the Sharans. She could only guess from his words that their entire nation followed him. This was as bad as the Seanchan. Worse, the Seanchan captured and used Aes Sedai, but they didn't slaughter the common people with such recklessness. Egwene had to survive to escape. She needed to bring this information to the White Tower. The Aes Sedai would have to face Demondred. Light send that enough of their number had escaped the battle earlier to do so. Why had Demondred sent for Rand? Everyone knew where to find the Dragon Reborn. Egwene reached the mess tent, then crept around it. Guards chatted in the near distance. That Sharan accent was oddly monotone, as if the people had no emotions at all. It was as if the music was gone from their speech, music that Egwene hadn't realized was normally there. The ones speaking were men, so she probably didn't need to worry that they would sense her ability to channel. Still, Demondred had done it with Lyanna. Perhaps he had a Tarangreal for the purpose. Such things existed. She gave the men a wide berth anyway and continued on into the darkness of what had once been her camp. She moved past fallen tents, the scent of smoldering fires still lingering in the air, and crossed a path that she had taken most evenings while collecting troop reports. It was disturbing how quickly one could go from being in a position of power to slinking through camp like a rat. Being suddenly unable to channel changed so many things. "My authority is not drawn from my power to channel," she told herself. "My strength is in control, understanding, and care. I will escape this camp, and I will continue the fight." She repeated those words, fighting off a creeping sense of powerlessness, the feeling of despair at so many dead, the tingling between her shoulder blades as if someone were watching her in the darkness. Light. Poor Lyanna. Something hit the bare earth near her. It was followed by two more pebbles dropping to the ground. Gawain apparently didn't trust in just one. She moved quickly to the remnants of a nearby tent, half burned, the other half of the canvas hanging from the poles. She crouched down. At that moment she realized a half-burned body was lying on the ground mere inches from her. He was Shainaran, she saw, in a flash of lightning from the rumbling clouds above, though he wore the symbol of the White Tower on his shirt. He lay with one eye up toward the sky, silent, the other side of his head burned down to the skull. A light appeared from the direction she'd been heading. She waited, tense, as two Sharan guards approached, bearing a lantern. They didn't speak. As they turned to walk southward along their route, she could see that their armor had symbols etched across the back that mimicked the tattoos she'd seen on men earlier. These marks were quite extravagant, and so, by her best guess, the men were actually of low rank. The system disturbed her. You could always add to a person's tattoo, but she knew of no way to remove one. Having the tattoos grow more intricate the lower one was in society implied something. People could fall from grace, but they could not rise once fallen or born to a lowly position. She sensed the channeler behind her mere moments before a shield slammed between Egwene and the source. Egwene reacted immediately. She didn't give terror time to gain purchase. She grabbed her belt knife and spun toward the woman she could sense approaching from behind. Egwene lunged, but a weave of air snatched her arm and held it tightly. Another one filled her mouth, gagging her. Egwene thrashed, but other weaves grabbed her and hauled her into the air. The knife dropped from her twitching fingers. A globe of light appeared nearby, a soft blue aura, much dimmer than that of a lantern. It had been created by a woman with dark skin and very refined features, delicate, a small nose, a slender frame. She stood up from her crouch, and Egwene found her to be quite tall, nearly as tall as a man. "You are a dangerous little rabbit," the woman said, her thick, toneless accent making her difficult to understand. She emphasized words in the wrong places and pronounced many sounds in a just-off way. She had the tattoos on her face like delicate branches reaching from the back of her neck forward onto her cheeks. She also wore one of those dresses, shaped like a cow's bell, black, with strands of white tied a handspan below the neck. The woman touched her arm where Egwene's knife had nearly taken her. "Yes," the woman said. "Very dangerous. Few of the Ayad would reach for a dagger so quickly, rather than for the source. You have been trained well." Egwene struggled in her bonds, It was no use. They were tight. Her heart began racing, but she was better than that. Panic would not save her. She forced herself to be calm. No, she thought. No, panic won't save me, but it may alert Gawain. She could sense that he was worried out there somewhere in the darkness. With effort, she allowed her terror to rise. She let go of all of her careful Aes Sedai training. It was not nearly as easy as she had expected.
You move quietly, little rabbit, the Sharan woman said, inspecting Egwene. I would never have been able to follow you if I hadn't already known you were moving in this direction.
She walked around Egwene, looking curious.
You watched the Wild's little show all the way through, did you? Brave or stupid?
Egwene shut her eyes and focused on her terror, her sheer panic. She had to bring Gawain to her. She reached within and opened the tight little nugget of emotion she'd packed there, her fear at being captured again by the Seanchan. She could feel it, the Adam on her neck, the name, Tuli, a name for a pet. Egwene had been younger then, but no more powerless than she was now. It would happen again. She would be nothing. She would have her very self stripped away. She would rather be dead. Oh, light! Why couldn't she have died? She'd sworn she'd never be captured like this again. She began to breathe quickly, now unable to control her terror.
Now, now, the Sharan said.
She seemed amused, though her tone was so flat, Egwene couldn't completely tell.
It won't be that bad now, will it? I have to decide which will gain me more. Turning you over to him, or keeping you for myself.
Strong channeling came suddenly from the far side of the camp, where Demondred had gone. The Sharan glanced that way, but didn't seem alarmed. Egwene could feel Gawain approaching. He was very worried. Her message had served its purpose, but he wasn't coming quickly enough, and he was farther away than she'd expected. What was wrong? Now that she'd let her worry out of its hidden place, it overwhelmed her, beating against her a series of blows.
Your man, the Sharan said. You have one of them. What are they called again? Odd that you should rely on the protection of a man, but you never reach your potential in this land, I'm told. He will be taken. I've sent for him.
As Egwene had feared. Light. She'd led Gawain to this. She'd led the army to disaster. Egwene squeezed her eyes shut. She'd led the White Tower to its destruction. Her parents would be slaughtered. The two rivers would burn. She should have been stronger. She should have been smarter. No. She had not been broken by the Seanchan. She would not be broken by this. Egwene opened her eyes and met the gaze of the Sharan in the soft blue light. Egwene wrestled her emotions to stillness and felt the Aes Sedai calm envelop her.
You are an odd one, the Sharan whispered,
still held by Egwene's eyes. So transfixed was she that the woman didn't notice when the shadow moved up behind her. A shadow that could not have been Gawain, for he was still distant. Something smashed into the woman's head from behind. She crumpled, slumping to the ground. The globe winked out instantly, and Egwene was free. She dropped to a crouch, fingers finding her knife. A figure moved up to her. Egwene raised her knife and prepared herself to embrace the source. She would draw attention if she had to. She would not be taken again. But who was this?
Hush, the figure said.
Egwene recognized the voice. Lyalwyn?
Others noticed this woman channeling, Lyalwyn said. They will come to see what she was doing. We must move.
You saved me,
Egwene whispered.
You rescued me.
I take my oaths seriously, Lyell Wynn said. Then, so softly that Egwene could barely hear it, she added,
Maybe too seriously. Such horrible omens this night.
They moved quickly through the camp for a few moments until Egwene sensed Gawain approaching. She couldn't make him out in the darkness. Finally, she whispered softly,
Gawain?
Suddenly, he was there, right next to her.
Egwene, who did you find?
Lyell Wynn stiffened, then hissed softly through her teeth. Something seemed to have upset her greatly. Perhaps she was angry at having someone sneak up on her. If that was the case, Egwene shared the emotion. She'd been taking pride in her abilities, and then she'd been blindsided not only by a channeler, but now by Gawain. Why should a boy raised in the city be able to move so well without her spotting him?
I didn't find anyone, Egwene whispered.
Lyell Wynn found me, and she pulled me out of a fire.
Lyell Wynn?
Gawain said, peering through the darkness. Egwene could feel his surprise and his suspicion.
We must keep moving, Lyell Wynn said.
I will not argue with that, Gawain replied. We're almost out. We'll want to go a little to the north, though. I left some bodies just to the right.
Bodies? Lyell Wynn asked.
Half a dozen or so Sharans jumped me, Gawain said.
Half a dozen? Egwene thought. He made it sound as if it were nothing. This was not the place for discussion. She joined the other two, heading out of the camp, Lyell Wynn leading them in a specific direction. Each noise or shout from the camp made Egwene wince, worried that one of the bodies had been found. In fact, she nearly jumped all the way to the storm clouds above when someone spoke from the darkness.
Do that be you?
It is us, Bale, Lyell Wynn said softly.
My aged grandmother,
Bale Domon exclaimed softly, joining them.
You found her. Woman, you do amaze me again.
He hesitated.
I do wish you'd have let me come with you.
My husband, Lyell Wynn whispered. You are as brave and stout a man as any woman could wish on her crew. But you move with all of the stillness of a bear charging through a river.
He grunted, but joined them as they left the edge of the camp, quietly and carefully. About 10 minutes away, Egwene finally trusted herself to embrace the source. Glorying in it, she made a gateway for them and skimmed to the White Tower. Avienda ran with the rest of the Aiel through gateways. They surged like floodwaters into the valley of Thakandar, two waves rushing down from opposite sides of the valley. Avienda did not carry a spear. That was not her place. Instead, she was a spear. She was joined by two men in black coats, five wise ones, the woman Olivia, and 10 of Rand's sworn Aes Sedai with warders. None of them save Olivia had responded well to having Avienda placed above them. The Ashaman did not like having to answer to any woman. The wise ones didn't like being ordered by Rand at all, and the Aes Sedai still thought of Aiel channelers as inferior. They all obeyed the order anyway. Rand had whispered to her in a quiet moment to watch them all for dark friends. Fear did not make him speak those words, but his sense of realism. Shadows could creep up anywhere. There were Trollocs here in the valley and some Murdral, but they had not anticipated this attack. The Aiel took advantage of their disarray and commenced a slaughter. Avienda led her group of channelers toward the forge, that massive gray-roofed building. The shadow forgers turned from their inexorable movement, showing just a hint of confusion. Avienda wove fire at one, removing its head from its shoulders. The body turned to stone, then started to crumble. That seemed a signal to the other channelers, and shadow forgers through the valley began to explode. They were said to be terrible warriors when provoked, with skin that turned aside swords. That might just be rumor, as few Aiel had ever actually danced the spears with a shadow forger. Avienda didn't particularly want to discover the truth. She let her team end the first group of shadow forgers and tried not to think too hard about the death and destruction these things had caused during their unnatural lives. The shadow spawn tried to mount a defense, some of the Murdral screaming and whipping at their trollocs to charge and break the Aiel attack that came at them across a broad front. It would have been easier to stop a river with a handful of twigs. The Aiel didn't slow, and those shadow spawn who tried to resist were slain in their tracks, often falling to multiple spears or arrows. Most of the trollocs broke and ran, fleeing before the thunder of Aiel yells. Avienda and her channelers reached the forges and the nearby pens of dirty, lifeless-eyed captives who had been awaiting death. "Quickly," Avienda said to the warders who accompanied her. The men broke open pens as Avienda and the others attacked the last of the shadow forgers. As they died, falling to stone and dust, they dropped half-finished Thakandar blades to the rocks. Avienda looked upward to the right. A long serpentine path led up toward the cavern maw in the side of the mountain that loomed above. The hole there was dark. It seemed a trap that tempted light to enter, then never released it. Avienda wove fire and spirit, then released the weave into the air. A moment later, a gateway opened at the head of the path up to Sheol Ghul. Four figures stepped through. A woman in blue, small of stature but not of will. An aging man, white-haired and shrouded in a multi-hued cloak. A woman in yellow, her dark hair cut short, adorned with an assortment of gemstones set in gold. And a tall man, hair the color of living coals. He wore his coat of red and gold, but under it a simple Two Rivers shirt, what he had become and what he had been, wrapped together in one. He carried two swords, like a Shinaran. One looked as if it were glass. He wore it upon his back. The other was the sword of the Tree Killer, King Laemon, tied at his waist. He carried that because of her. Fool man. Avienda raised her hand to him, and he raised his in return. That would be their only farewell if he failed in his task or she died during hers. With a last look, she turned away from him and toward her duty. Two of her Aes Sedai had linked and created a gateway so that the warders could usher the captives to safety. Many needed to be prodded into motion. They stumbled forward, eyes nearly as dead as those of the shadow forgers. "Check inside the forge, too," Avienda said, motioning to a few of the warders. They charged in, Aes Sedai following. Weaves of the One Power shook the building as they found more shadow forgers, and the two Ashaman quickly went in as well. Avienda scanned the valley. The battle had become uglier. There were more shadow spawn at the corridor leading out of the valley. These had been given more time to prepare and form up. Iteralda led his forces in behind the Aiel, securing the sections of the valley already taken. Patience, Avienda thought to herself. Her job would not be to join that battle ahead, but to guard Rand's back as he ascended and entered the Pit of Doom. She worried about one thing. Couldn't the Forsaken just travel directly into the cavern itself? Rand didn't seem worried about that, but he was also very distracted by what he had to do. Perhaps she should join him and... She frowned, looking up. What was that shadow? High above, the sun shone in a turbulent sky. Some storm clouds, in patches, some deep black, others brilliant white. It wasn't a cloud that had suddenly obscured the sun, however, but something solid and black, sliding into place. Avienda felt a chill and found herself trembling as the light slipped away. Darkness, true darkness, fell Soldiers across the field looked up in awe and even fear. The light went out. The end of the world had come. Channeling came suddenly from the other end of the wide valley. Avienda spun, shaking off her awe. The ground nearby was littered with torn garments, dropped weapons, and corpses. All of the fighting was at the mouth of the valley, distant from her, where the Aiel were trying to push the Shadow Spawn back into the pass. Though Avienda couldn't see much through the darkness, she could tell soldiers were staring at the sky. Even the Trollocs looked awestruck. But then the solid blackness began to move in the sky, revealing first the edge of the sun, and then the sun itself. Light. The end was not upon them. The battle at the mouth of the valley resumed, but it was obviously difficult. Making the Trollocs retreat through such narrow confines was like trying to shove a horse through a small crack in a wall. Impossible, unless you started doing some carving. There, Avienda said, pointing toward the side of the valley behind the Aiel lines. I sense channeling by a woman.
Light, but she's powerful, Nasuna breathed.
Circle, Avienda yelled. Now! The others linked, feeding Avienda control of the circle. Power filled her. Unimaginable power. It was as if she drew in a breath, but just kept being able to take in more air, filling, expanding, crackling with energy. She was a thunderstorm, a vast sea of the one power. She thrust her hands forward, letting loose a raw weave only half formed. This was almost too much power for her to shape. Air and fire spurted from her hands, a column of it as wide as a man with arms outstretched. The fire flared as a thick, hot, near liquid. Not bale fire. She was smarter than that. But dangerous nonetheless. The air contained the fire in a concentrated mass of destruction. The column streaked across the battlefield, melting the stone beneath and starting corpses aflame. A huge swath of fog vanished with a hiss, and the ground shook as the column plowed into the side of the valley wall where the enemy channeler, Avienda could only assume it was one of the Forsaken from her strength, had been attacking the back ranks of Aiel. Avienda released the weave, her skin slick with sweat. A smoldering black column of smoke rose from the valley wall. Molten rock trickled down the slope. She grew still, waiting, alert. The one power inside of her actually started to strain, as if trying to escape her. Was that because some of the energy she used came from men? Never before had the one power seemed to want to destroy her. She had only a brief warning. A frantic moment of channeling from the other side of the valley, followed by an enormous rush of wind. Avienda sliced that wind down the center with an invisible weave the size of a great forest tree. She followed it with another blast of fire, this time more controlled. No, she didn't dare use balefire. Rand had warned her. That could widen the bore. Break the framework of reality in a place where that membrane was already thin. Her enemy didn't have the same restriction. The woman's next attack came as a white-hot bar, narrowly missing Avienda, drilling through the air a finger's width from her head, before hitting the wall of the forge behind. The balefire sliced a wide swath of stone and brick from the wall, and the building collapsed with a crash. Good riddance, Avienda thought, throwing herself to the ground. Spread out, she ordered the others. Don't give her good targets. She channeled, stirring up air to create a tempest of dust and debris in front of them. Then she used a weave to mask the fact that she was holding to the one power and hide her from her enemy. She scuttled in a low crouch behind some nearby cover, a heap of slag and broken bits of iron, waiting to be smelted. Balefire struck again, hitting the stony ground where she'd been before. It punctured stone as easily as a spear went through a melon.